Chapter 2 and the Iaga Contact. Aboard the alien spacecraft. Good God! Miriam's exclamation so early in the morning reflected both surprise and repulsion. In answer to my repeated knocking signals, the huge, round platform had risen again above the surface of the water and now, in broad daylight, the sight was much more impressive. The slightly domed platform lay, just as it had yesterday evening, with its edge level with the surface of the water. Its surface was for the most part as smooth as polished stone and dark gray in color with scattered patches of off-white which made it appear as though someone had been throwing around bags of flour. Over this otherwise perfectly smooth surface ran innumerable ragged, charred grooves which ended in a small crater, as though something had exploded there. Nearly all the scratches and grooves ran in one direction and gave the impression that the spaceship had been grazed by enemy fire or that someone had been at work with a blowtorch. All in all, it was an ominous sight, and Miriam's reaction was not very reasoning. "Stuff, please don't go. Something as alien as that can only spell trouble for us all." She was right, of course. There was something wrong about entering this thing. But even the latent fear from last evening and the leaden feeling in my stomach brought on by the sight of this forbidding platform were not enough to hold me back. A few moments later I was sitting on the edge of the platform, drying my feet after wading through the water. I donned my shoes and socks and, armed with sandwiches, thermos and notepaper, I began to look for the opening that they had described. I had hardly taken a couple of steps when around. Safe-like door slowly began to open near the edge and a small quantity of sand and water which had settled in the jump was blown away by a stream of compressed air. I went closer and looked down through a round hole, about 3 feet in diameter, into a cube-shaped space about 8 feet across. Once again, I heard the voice. "Welcome on board. Be careful as you come below. The ladder is dangerous for you." Indeed. The ladder was nothing more than a pole with staggered steps on either side formed to place my feet. I stopped in my descent and waved to Miriam, saying, "Don't worry. I'll be back around 5 o'clock. The reception has been very friendly, and it's really quite cozy in here." Once below, I cast my eyes around the room. Unimaginably complicated equipment lined the walls and the ceiling. The only things that were vaguely familiar were huge reels and drums, wound with every possible size of cable and pipe. In the floors was a metal door that looked remarkably earthly, with a round knob in the middle over which I nearly stumbled. In one corner stood a kind of desk with rows of knobs, and above, a panoramic screen, about 5 feet long and 3 feet high, that glowed with a soft green fluorescent light. Behind the desk stood a strangely normal-looking chair with a metal frame and leather upholstery. The voice invited me to sit and explained that the seat had unlimited possibilities for adjustment but that certain instructions from the voice would be necessary before I could be comfortably seated. "Yes, thank you. What happens now?" Introductions would seem to be the best way to start. "Will you answer a few questions?" "Yes, of course. How should we address you?" "Call me Stiff." "All right, Stiff. The language we speak is not your own language, although it seems to be. It is the language of all living species in this universe. Even a plant or an animal will understand it. This language was spoken on Earth before the Babylonian confusion of tongues. You don't hear words but sounds that are directly reflected by your emotional structure, the life field. Therefore, don't try to understand words. But listen to the reflections of your soul. Is that a kind of thought transference?" "Not exactly, but you can compare it with that." "I understand. How old are you?"
"I am 43.
"Are you in good health?"
"Yes, perfect."
"Have you a high social function?"
"High?
What do you mean by high?"
"I am the director of a business with a few hundred employees."
"So you are a representative of the directing class of the West Bloc. Huskmotetsk Jedpa 60 Toilet." "I don't quite understand the question. What do you mean by West Bloc?"
"Let us ask, then, are you a supporter of a free economy?"
"Yes, without a doubt." "Now it is your turn. Would you perhaps like to see us from Dose Up?" I tensed involuntarily,
and my heart began to beat faster. I am afraid that I will get a shock if I see you. That is true. Nothing is more intense than a visual confrontation with another intelligent race. Do you feel strong enough not to panic? Now that I know that I have nothing to fear from you, I will not panic. You certainly have nothing to fear from us, on the contrary, we are indebted to you. Look through the window to the right of the screen. When we turn on the light, you will be able to look into our navigation room. Ready? Right, then. Here we go. I looked into a huge, round chamber, about 45 feet across and 9 feet high. From the decompression chamber I could see over the greatest part of the navigation area, with its vast contents of instruments and control panels. Strangely, all the instruments and panels were mounted on the floor with walkways alongside and separated by vertical metal grills that reached the roof. Everything was dark blue in color, almost black, causing a very strange lighting effect. The dominating blue-black surfaces acted as an almost invisible background against which all the white or polished metal knobs, handles and instruments stood out in dire relief as though luminous. The encompassing vertical wall of the dome looked as though it was made of glass. The highly polished material reflected strongly and gave a very strange lighting effect from the reflections. On many of the panels, diversely colored lights burned, interposed by dark transparent strips on which flashes or darting lines could be seen. An imposing piece of technology. I suddenly realized that there was no sign of life whatsoever. Well, where are you, then? Prepare yourself. You may see us now. A light came on, illuminating an area directly in front of the window. I sprang back. In spite of my mental preparation, the paralyzing fear had returned quite suddenly and cold shivers ran over my scalp, through my neck and over my shoulders. On the other side of the window, in a half circle as though at a conference table, sat 8 strange humanoid beings. Their faces and forms radiated as much primitive animal power as haughty intelligence superiority. I felt again the uncertainty of yesterday, a reaction to their obvious superiority and self-assurance. I am convinced that any intelligent man would have felt the same, and that this reaction is a part of our makeup. The same feeling that I did not belong here, that even these steel walls could not protect me from the mental impact made by this intelligent pressure group from a much higher level of civilization and development, with their fantastic knowledge, belonging to a strange, distant world. Their unearthly, somewhat animal, faces, with a dynamic expressive ability, emphasize the difference in our places of origin to such an extent that I am convinced it touches areas that to us are still taboo, and which have been since time began. When you are unable to draw, how on earth can you expect someone else to draw a face that he has never dreamed existed? How can you create a portrait with words? My friend, Rudolf Duss, who accepted the task of drawing the pictures of this book, was driven nearly to distraction by my dubious attempts to produce a good likeness, one which would demonstrate their superiority. He finally convinced me that even a photograph would not effectively convey what I had in mind. The facial expressions must be left, unhappily, to the imagination of the reader. It was the hypnotic effect of their eyes, with their large, rectangular pupils, that made the deepest impression on me. They were the thoughtful, peaceful eyes of deep philosophical thinkers that were studying me with quizzical friendliness. Their heads were about the same size as ours, only slightly deeper toward the back, and in the middle of the skull was a bony ridge that changed into a deep groove in the center of the forehead. It gave the impression of a skull divided into 2 separate compartments. Toward the back of their heads the ridge ended in a semicircular muscle formation that ran down the neck and into the shoulders, making the side view of the neck much heavier looking than ours. The same is true of the whole construction of their bodies. They were much more solidly built than we are. Their arms and shoulders, although of much the same proportions as ours, were much heavier and more muscular and, combined with the claw-like hands, gave an impression of strength that would have come a dose second to a bench vise. All this combined with their broad chests and short stocky legs made them look as though they would not even step out of the path of a gorilla. Their muscle tissue also seemed to be different, more like solid rubber, and their thin skin followed the contours of their muscles more closely than ours. The top of the head to the back of the neck was covered with short, smooth hair that shone like the coat of a smooth, furry animal. The color of this hair was different with each of them. Rust brown, gold and silver gray showed either separately or mixed. Their hairless skin had a pale, glass-like sheen to it. Along the edges of the face the skin showed slightly darker gray-brown than in the middle. As they turned their heads, the skin seemed to reflect the light and shade of their surroundings. This changing color effect was something that caught my attention many times. Their teeth were two seamless white strips, above and below, that closed in a scissor-like fashion. Both their teeth and the yellow white of their eyes reflected the strange lighting in such a way that their faces looked slightly artificial. Their movements were also strange. They could sit or stand perfectly still for much longer periods and more often than we would even attempt, but when in action, their movements were lightning fast and emphasized their tremendous strength. They were like volcanoes. After a period of rest, they would erupt into a wave of energy and temperament that would have made a Spaniard jealous. They were wearing a kind of uniform in the form of dark blue, silky overalls, with three-quarter sleeves and a deep V-neck. Under this was a white shirt with a rather old-fashioned high collar around the back of the neck. Around their waists was a broad, gold-colored belt, decorated with what seemed to be atom formations, which ran along the edge of the deep V in the neck as well, incorporating, however, still other motifs in its design. I decided to end the silent confrontation. I'm sorry that it's taken so long to get used to the sight of you. More of the main text later in this file. The following is text for the picture of the humanoid from Iarga, humanoid from the planet Iarga, which is a little more than 10 light years away from Earth. Although these beings have the same origin and identity as man, and their physique is comparable in many ways, there appear to be many great differences which result from the different planetary conditions. Their planet is larger, the gravity is nearly 3 grams, and the atmosphere pressure is more than 7 bar with higher nitrogen and ammonia contents than our air. The average wind speed is less than ours. But the denser atmosphere in combination with heavy rains and the higher terminal velocities, sometimes cause storms that an unprotected human could not survive. To withstand these conditions, they have a short, compact physique with well-developed muscles, especially the legs, armored skulls, and deep-set eyes. Their darting movements are interposed with periods of rest, during which they only move their heads. They walk stiffly, with short steps, as if they are walking on ice. They were originally amphibians, and really belong in the water. Their bodies are as streamlined as that of a seal, and are covered with short smooth hair, like an otter. Their hands and feet are large and broad, and they have webs between their fingers and toes. We could not possibly compete with them in a swimming race. They are capable of killing a small whale sort by ramming it like a torpedo. A group will then tow the catch back to the shore. Swimming. Their sex drives are different from ours, and they find sex less important, partly because they derive less pleasure from it than we do. The population growth is slow, and they lack the sex signals of humans, such as full lips, earlobes, pointed nose, protruding female breasts and the external male sex organ. This is why it is not necessary for them to cover their bodies as we do. Their reproduction impulse is born of love and not lust. We seem to be abnormal in this respect. Their weak point is the development of their individuality. They do almost everything in groups, tribes, they think collectively and they obey the laws of their society to the letter. They live for and through the friendship and love within the group. Hear further on the talk with those space people. We have only compliments for you. You have remarkable self-control. You demonstrated the same quality with your rescue of our crewman, for which we would once more like to offer our thanks. Oh, that was nothing. When I see all the technical capabilities at your disposal, I wonder if my help was really necessary. The value of an unselfish deed cannot in any way be influenced by asking afterwards if it could not have been done in some other way. As a matter of fact, Your help came so quickly and efficiently that it would have been impossible for us to have managed it in a shorter time. It was precisely this speed and efficiency that gave us the idea that you could possibly be a man with whom we could communicate, the first communication with a representative of this world. Make sure that you realize what this conversation will demand of you. You will be speaking with a race that is far ahead of yours in evolution. This means not only an enormous technical lead, but also the same lead in mental development and inner culture. This last is the most difficult to explain, and yet we must make it dear if you are to understand what social stability represents. We will therefore lead you, step by step, through the secrets of a highly developed culture, and we will do this by means of a holographic film which will take you to our planet Iaga. We will let you see what the world civilization really means. It will be an interesting experience for you, the value of which is impossible for you to judge at this moment. But what you also cannot judge is the personal danger involved. We know the dangers and will protect you against them. The most important thing for us is to ensure that your freedom of thought is not damaged. Freedom of thought is the essence of humanity, and if we were to damage that, we would, according to our ethics, be committing a crime. Therefore, we will only convey knowledge to you, and not convictions. We wish no discussions. We will only answer questions when you do not understand something, and we will remain silent when you do not agree with us. We will help you to climb the ladder of knowledge, rung by rung, first to social stability, then to the superculture and, if you can follow this, to the misty heights of cosmic integration. We will only give you knowledge. You must remain free to do with this knowledge what you will. If as a result of this knowledge you should find yourself forming any convictions, do so with care. Make sure that they are lasting convictions, born of independent creative thinking, and not the sort of passing convictions that the impact of strenuous visual emotions tend to provoke. These pseudo-convictions paralyze individual freedom and they make men rigid and dogmatic. Knowledge is a material part of the human condition and, as with all material things, it can be mechanized or automated. We have at our disposal a method of teaching that utilizes a certain type of radiation. This takes place at a speed of which you never dreamed. Above your head we have fitted one of these radiation reflectors. It makes the spoken word unnecessary to a great extent. On the screen in front of you we will show our explanation in the form of a picture story, the words of which serve only to direct your attention in a certain direction. We call this fixing the concentration, but the true source of information is the radiation. You do not have to take notes, information gained through radiation remains locked in the memory forever. Experience this adventure with an open mind. Anything else will disturb your concentration. Do not become angry if we say something that goes against your principles. We have no intention of antagonizing you. If we do so, understand that it is purely a result of our ignorance regarding the many taboos and prejudices of Western man. They started the radiation device working with the film. At first I was not quite sure what was happening. I felt cold and somewhat lightheaded suddenly, a feeling comparable to having had a little too much wine. You believe you can think very dearly but you feel somewhat removed from reality. The fantastic film projection was accompanied by a rather childish description of what was to be seen. Now and then a few words brought my attention to the size of something, the height, the speed, the form or the connection between two things, and so on. An endless stream of words and short sentences formed a slender thread of explanation. The essence, the real information, reached me unnoticed, and that was a weird experience. The knowledge that these beings, through their machine, could feed information directly into my brain, strengthened my feeling that I did not belong here. The difference between us was too great. I was defenseless. As far as I can gather, radiated information is a combination of visual stimulants and thought transference, all of which takes place at fantastic speed. The images came in such rapid succession that at first it made me irritable, and only after some considerable time did it become dear what was expected of me. I had only to act as a relaxed spectator, who observes with interest what is happening, they did the rest. It is understandable that this type of information is not suited to the written word, and therefore I have attempted to relate everything in the form of a two-sided conversation. This tends to give the impression that I was a partner in an animated discussion, but nothing is further from the truth. My function during this meeting can be compared with that of a tape recorder. The authenticity of the hologram was so fantastic that it could no longer be described as a picture. As long as I kept my head in the correct position, it was just like looking through a window. The three-dimensional, panoramic, color screen offered so persuasive an illusion of reality that after the first few minutes I looked behind the screen to make sure that nothing was there. The adjustment of the picture was controlled by several of the many knobs and handles on the desk in front of me. My first experience with the radiation took the form of knowing, without further instruction, which of the knobs I had to use to adjust, for example, the focus or the position of the picture on the screen. The test card, a jungle of vertical stripes, vanished, and I looked into a great, black hole in the middle of which hung a blinding ball. I recoiled involuntarily, at which the picture blurred, but I quickly got control of myself. The hole was very deep. I was looking into the endlessness of the cosmos. Against the black, somewhat violet background, sown with thousands of stars, a gigantic, pink-white ball hung in stately beauty. The planet Iarga. The sight was very moving. I felt as though I was really present in space, and a strange emotion began to flow through me. The cloud formation was, in contrast with that of Earth, unbroken, with small, swirling patterns that caught the sunlight. The pink patches occurred where the sun was able to penetrate deeper into the clouds. Most remarkable were two gigantic, flat, concentric rings which formed a halo around the planet. They were rather like the rings of our Saturn, except that these consisted of a small inner ring and a much broader outer ring, both casting a sharp band of shadow on the clouds. There was also a large moon to be seen, with the same pockmarked surface as ours. Iarga, the home of these astronauts, is a planet in another solar system, not much more than 10 light years away from US. More details of the location of the planet they would not tell me. The diameter and mass are much greater than the Earth's, the gravitational force is greater, and the atmosphere is much thicker. The speed of rotation is much slower than that of Earth, so that the duration of day and night is longer, but the regular tilting of the rings around the planet change certain days into nights and certain nights into days, due to the fact that the rings reflect the sunlight. As a result, Iarga does not have the regular pattern of day and night that we know. Because of the thicker atmosphere and higher air pressure, which is of a different composition than ours, Iarga knows no bright sunlight, and sees nothing of the moon or stars. A permanent layer of mist exists at the higher levels of the atmosphere which filters the sunlight. The color blue only appears in lighter tints, and green is more pronounced than here, which may account for the fact that they seem to have a preference for blue in their artificial lighting. They describe the Earth as the blue planet with the blinding light, and, in contrast, Iarga as the green planet with the misty light. The living conditions are very different from those on Earth. Temperature extremes are much less than here. But when you hear that the wind speed can reach 3 times our maximum, and that rain and snowfall can be as much as 10 times greater, and you combine this with the fact that the terminal velocity is much higher, it becomes clear that it would be very unwise for any of us to be caught in a rainstorm on Iarga. After being informed that a fall from a height of 6 feet was fatal, I began to understand a little more of the reason for the physical appearance of these Iargans. The rubbery muscle formations, armored skulls and long arms were products of very different climatic conditions than ours. The earthquakes also seemed to occur with more intensity and frequency than ours. Just as I was beginning to ask myself what the buildings on such a planet would be like, the picture changed and showed the view from a fast-moving spaceship that had just passed through the outer layer of mist around the planet. Initially, I saw only clouds, above me, the pink layer of mist that I had seen earlier, then a second, broken cloud layer which was primarily responsible for the strange, diffused light on the planet. We passed through this layer at a height of about 20 miles, and viewed from the underside it was a mixture of yellow-gray, brown and greenish clouds that gave a very somber and threatening impression. Lastly came a cloud layer that in height, form and color, closely resembled ours, and after passing through this, I had an unobstructed view of the surface. We flew over a bright green ocean with white wave crests. Above the water ran an orange strip as straight as an arrow, which, separated by a white beached horseshoe-shaped island, split and continued in different directions. It was only when the spaceship came steadily lower that I realized what this strip was. A railway bridge. On long, slim towers, high above the water, ran a bridge as far as the eye could see. Along this bridge, slim shining torpedoes moved in both directions. Their speed was only slightly less than that of the spaceship, and there were far too many of them for me to count. The distance between the torpedoes was about 10 times their own length, all spaced exactly alike along an 8-4 rack system which was divided into 2 layers, one above the other. I had little time to study the trains further, for we moved on. Land came into view, a low-lying coast, split by a broad river with large adjoining lakes, and before my astonished eyes a strange, unearthly panorama unfolded. For as far as the eye could see, the land was divided by the orange railway into regular rectangles. The long torpedoes moved between huge, glass, oil tank-like constructions with shiny dome-shaped roofs. Areas of green on either side of the railway looked something like prehistoric forests. The longer I studied this landscape, the more I became aware that this was ribbon development in its extreme form. The area between the buildings seemed to be used namely for agriculture, only now and then making way for an industrial complex. The camera sped on. The landscape changed and became undulating, split by walls into huge terraces which compared with the wine fields of Italy. Behind this lay mountains, and in a great bowl between the peaks a red-brown lake came into view. The machine tilted its nose steadily lower until I was able to see vertically below. Around the shores of the lake, numerous buildings were to be seen, among which were several gigantic cones. In 3 places, powerful blue-white lights, flanked by orange lights, flashed. Everything pointed to the fact that the spaceship was going to land here, and just at the last second, before the picture vanished, I saw something that made me catch my breath. On the right side of the screen, low above the lake, 3 shiny disks hung like sentries in the air. They had the form of perfect, streamlined discuses. I saw flying saucers. You saw 3 of our aircraft. In the form of a saucer? Exactly. And if you are interested, we will let you see them. I certainly am. Did you come here in something like that? No. These aircraft have about as much in common with our spacecraft as an Indian arrow has with your Mars probe. We hope that you have more important questions to ask than about aircraft. Of course. Am I to understand that the glass tanks are your houses? Yes, we call them house rings because they are in fact built in the form of a ring with a covered central recreation area. Is the whole planet built in this way? Yes, all areas that are suitable for living are built in this manner. The screen showed a view of a living area from a great height. So you all live in the same type of house? From the outside they are all the same, but inside there is great variation. The uniformity appalls me. Do your top men also live in the cylinders? I had an idea, judging from the length of the trains, which I guessed were about 150 feet, that these buildings were enormous, at least 900 feet in diameter and more than 300 feet high. The words top men suggest something of the Earth's ideas of status. You surely do not imagine that in a higher civilization, standards of justice can exist that allow status to play a part? I don't see what status has to do with more variation in house building. Why not simpler, smaller houses with more privacy? Small houses with separate pieces of land form a system that you call towns, and such inefficiency is unthinkable to us. Why inefficient? When you have our problem of overpopulation, you must build large cities to house all the people. We cannot afford the luxury of large areas of woodland as you can. What do you call overpopulation? Our small country has more than 300 people to the square kilometer, which in my opinion is quite dense. Compared to Earth's average of 25 to the square kilometer, that is indeed dense. Estimate the number of people living in the area that you see here. Every ring houses about 10,000.